it happened on Arba'in, but not on Arba'in of the year 61 after Hijrah. It happened on Arba'in of 62 or another year, because they also believe that it's not possible for Ahlul Bayt to be present in the land of Karbala in 61 after Hijrah. But the narrations tell us about the occurrence of this event, so it must be in the year 62 after Hijrah.
But according to some historical accounts, even before Arba'in, Imam al-Sajjad, by the miracle of Allah, got to the city of Karbala, isn't it? And buried the martyrs over there, because recognizing the martyrs was difficult. So Imam al-Sajjad did so by travel. Is it true?
Yeah, this is another story. When it comes to burying Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and especially joining the body to the heads of the martyrs of Karbala, we know that a group of people from Banu Asad, they also came to the same land to bury them. Now, according to some narrations, because some scholars believe that an infallible imam can only be buried by the next infallible imam. So according to these narrations, Banu Asad, first of all, were not able to recognize the bodies, and second of all, they were not able to bury Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, because he should have been buried only by Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. So here, what happened exactly, a famous idea among Shia scholars is that it is a kind of miracle by Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, based on the concept of what we call the Tayyul Ard. So he was present in the land of Karbala, and he was the one who instructed Banu Asad and joined the bodies to the heads, and he buried Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. But now we're talking about the caravan, about the family of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and all the children and women coming back from Damascus. Now, I would like to... So it's a matter of discussion among the Shia scholars. As I mentioned, there are three viewpoints. But the famous idea is that they came back to the land of Karbala in 61 after Hijrah. So there are a couple of points which support this idea. I just mentioned these points, and then the discussion is open. The listeners can search more in this regard. Some people think that it was for the first time Sayyidina Tawus who has claimed that it happened in 61 after Hijrah. But when we search the historical sources, we see that no, before him, other Muslim scholars have referred to the same event. For example, the great Muslim scholar Abu Rehan Biruni, who passed away in 440, in Al-Athar al-Baqiya, he says that on the 20th of month of Safar, after the Ahlul Bayt came out of the city of Sham, Damascus, the heads of the martyrs were taken to Karbala and were buried next to the bodies. And these heads were taken by Imam Sajjad alayhi salam to Karbala. So this is Abu Rehan Biruni saying that Imam Sajjad came to the city of, to the land of Karbala in 61 after Hijrah.
That's right.
Imaduddin At-Tabari, who passed away in the 6th century after Hijrah, he also refers to the Ziyarah of Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari and also Hatiya. And when Jabir and Hatiya were visiting Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, they saw a caravan approaching them, and then they realized that they were Imam Sajjad alayhi salam and his family members. Also Ibn Namah Heli in Muthir al-Ahzan referred to the same point. So all these scholars agree that it happened in 61 after Hijrah.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Praise to Allah, The next point is that, as I explained about how Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was buried, there is another viewpoint of some scholars that, based on some historical reports, the heads of the martyrs of Karbala, especially the head of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, were taken by Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam and the Ahlul Bayt from Damascus to Karbala.
Yes.
There are a couple of, historical accounts in this regard. For example, Sheikh al-Saduq, who passed away in 381, he says that Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam and the Ahlul Bayt, accompanied by the heads of the martyrs, they came out of the city of Damascus and went back to Karbala and buried the heads. And also Fattal Nishaburi, he says, Kharaja Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam bin Niswa. Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam came out of Damascus together with the women, وَرَدَّ رَأْسَ الْحُسَيْنِ إِلَى كَرْبَلَى إِلَى كَرْبَلَى, and took the head of the holy head of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam to Karbala. Also, it's been mentioned by Ibn Shahrashub,
yes,
who passed away in 588, and some other scholars. And one of the very important issue about this question is that those people who believe that it cannot happen in 61 after Hijrah, they say that it took the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam some days to go from Karbala to Kufa, and then from Kufa to Damascus, and then they stayed in Damascus for some days. Mm-hmm. So it's not possible for them to be in Karbala again within 40 days. There are some answers to this claim as well. First of all, some people have claimed that the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam stayed in Damascus for 1 month, for 30 days. But some researchers believe that no, this claim is not true. It's not based on authentic narrations. And it was only few days, like, for example, 3 days, according to some historical reports. They stayed in the city of Damascus. And then if they have stayed for 2-3 days, it is possible for them to be present in Karbala again. For example, imagine they entered Syria in the first of Safar, and they stayed there for, like, 7 days, for example.
That's right.
They are able to come back to the city of Karbala within 12 days, for example. Mm-hmm. Because we have other historical events which tell us that, for example, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam went from Medina to Karbala within 5 days.
Yes.
Which is about 470 kilometers. And between Damascus to Karbala is about 600 kilometers, so it can be gone through, 10 days or 12 days, and some similar events. So as I mentioned, the supporters of this, the first viewpoint, are the majority, and they believe that the Ahlul Bayt went back to Karbala in Arba'in, 61 after Hijrah, and they have answered all these objections mentioned by the supporters of other viewpoints.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration regarding the commemoration of the day of Arba'in by the Ahlul Bayt, whether it was true or not. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam, PhD, and all the episode. God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min labani Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن
علي وحسين وحسن.
يوسف جلالي بتهران.
روباشافيت غازا.
جيروم هيوز بروسلز.
سعيد بورزا لندن.
رشا سغلام اسطنبول.
سيد امين عالمي كابول.
شاهانه بات Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Tehran has hosted a conference to discuss the effects of sanctions on the health of patients. Speaking at the event, Secretary of the Strategic Council of Foreign Relations Abbas Araghchi rejected the U.S. claims that medicine and food items are exempted from sanctions.
There might be such a thing on the surface, but in practice, the actions taken by the U.S. administration have imposed a strong sanction in this area. The U.S. sanctions against Iran cover a very wide network, and in addition to the humanitarian exceptions that they have apparently placed in the field of medicine, there are very detailed conditions by the Office of Foreign Assets Control of the U.S. Treasury Department in a way that makes their implementation practically impossible for pharmaceutical companies.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has led to a disruption in the accessibility of vital medical supplies for Iranian patients.
The most important report in this matter was submitted to the UN Human Rights Council last year by Mrs. Duhan, the special rapporteur on unilateral coercive measures of the United Nations. The U.S. and the West, self-proclaimed advocates of human rights, were against this reporter and even voted against the resolution to extend her mission. Even during her report presentation in September last year, they chose not to be present in the meeting hall. Self-criticism is not within their tolerance.
Although the U.S. claims that the sanctions do not directly ban the sales of medicines to Iran, they block every financial route needed to obtain drugs for patients suffering from diseases such as diabetes, kidney failure, hemophilia, multiple sclerosis, thalassemia, and leukemia.
Iranian officials have repeatedly condemned the sanctions against the Iranian nation as a crime against humanity, saying such unilateral restrictive measures have put the lives of vulnerable people at risk by hampering their access to medicine. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed to address the pressing cost of living crisis plaguing the nation. Attributing the situation to the global economic downturn, Erdogan has assured that his government will swiftly resolve this issue while upholding his promises to the people impacted by the devastating Fethiye earthquake. He had previously pledged to complete the reconstruction efforts within a year.
We vow to tackle the escalating cost of living caused by global crisis. We are aware that the cost of living has been suffocating our nation recently. As we have solved every problem of our country, I hope we will solve this problem again. We will not neglect anyone's right and will not leave anyone's expectations unanswered.
Analysts argue that this whole economic crisis is the result of wrong economic strategies and decisions made by the same ruling government for the past years, and they cannot fix what they have done now.
The people who created the problem and don't see it as a problem are very unlikely to fix it. For this reason, it's a naive to expect from the creator of the problem to solve the problem. I don't know on what basis the president is making these promises. He spoke about the cost of living, which has been getting higher for the past 2 years. Every month, we have a new raises in prices from foodstuff to rents and fuel. When the new government came and Mehmet Şimşek was appointed, we waited for something positive to happen. But the lira value against US dollar is dropping, and we're not seeing any new investments in the country. So where are all the new policies they want implement?
A few weeks ago, the vice president said that a new economic plan is to be revealed in September that will have a positive impact on the life of citizens, production and market, saying this plan will increase investments in the country.
Turkey, after the pandemic, was facing a few economic issues, just like other countries in the world, struggling to encounter post-lockdown repercussions, and then came the devastating earthquake, and then elections. So what we are facing, from inflation to change in lira value, is normal to what country has going through. However, I think the government's plan will ease the economic crisis. But it will take time, of course. When speaking about the economy, nothing can happen in one night.
This is why inflation is gaining a new momentum. The annual inflation went up from 38.2% to 47.8% in a single month in July. Lack of economic investments, inflation, low Turkish lira value against the US dollar, and high cost of living. This is how the Turkish economy is going now, with some blaming the pandemic and earthquake, while others say it is the government's wrong economic decisions. Amid the government promises and opposition criticism regarding Erdogan's extended tenure, there remains uncertainty regarding the potential success of the newly appointed economic team in swiftly executing their plans.
It's not that bad. Yes, the Turkish lira value has dropped and the cost of living has risen, but the government also raised the minimum wage and is trying to solve the economic problems which occurred due to the earthquake.
The ruling party must act fast to solve this economic crisis ahead of an upcoming critical local election, which will determine the fate of Istanbul, Ankara, and other major cities. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Around 800 delegates from 76 countries have arrived at the International Military Technical Forum held in Moscow region. Their presence showed a desire to strengthen and develop mutually beneficial cooperation with Russia, despite the West's anti-Russian sanctions. Addressing the participants, President Vladimir Putin noted that the U.S., along with NATO members, use all military and non-military means to pressure nations into submitting to their will, adding that all this is taking place amid a disintegrating arms control framework.
In particular, the United States intent on reformatting the existing system of interstate relations in the Asia-Pacific region as it deems fit. In fact, efforts to promote these so-called Indo-Pacific strategies are aimed at creating U.S.-led military and political associations. We cannot exclude that these efforts may pave the way to fully integrate NATO forces with the AUKUS structures as they take shape.
Putin stated Ukraine as a case which demonstrates where the Western policy of pouring oil on fire leads.
By pumping billions of dollars into the neo-Nazi regime and supplying it with equipment, arms and munitions, sending military advisors and mercenaries there, they are doing everything to further escalate the conflict and draw other countries into it.
According to the Russian defense minister, Ukraine's military resource is almost exhausted, and a special military operation has shown that there is nothing invulnerable to Russian weapons on the battlefield today.
No one should have any illusions that against the backdrop of a special military operation, Russian interests can be harmed. I wanted to draw attention to the fact that we also have cluster munitions in service. Until now, for humanitarian reasons, we have refrained from using them. However, this decision may be reconsidered.
This year, the forum is widely represented by weapons and military equipment that have already proven efficient in action. According to the Russian defense minister, the Russian army is expected to sign contracts worth over $4.7 billion at the forum. Iran has also presented a whole range of new combat drones.
Russia has expressed its determination to deepen technological partnerships and military technical cooperation with other countries and also continue taking advantage of the already established cooperation ties. The Army Expo's success is a clear indication that the West has lost most of its power in forcing countries to bend to its will. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
For the fourth time in 5 months, ex-President Donald Trump has been indicted and will be forced to stand trial, this time over alleged 2020 election interference in the state of Georgia. Ex-New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani joins Trump and nearly 20 others who will be collectively tried for violating a law normally associated with gangsters.
The indictment alleges that rather than abide by Georgia's legal process for election challenges, the defendants engaged in a criminal racketeering enterprise to overturn Georgia's presidential election result.
A conviction of racketeering in Georgia has a minimum prison sentence of 5 years. Polls have Trump as a certain lock to win the Republican presidential nomination, and he's neck and neck with incumbent President Joe Biden for next year's election. Trump has gained 8 points among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents since the first indictment was handed down, as the spate of court cases has many accusing the ruling party of persecuting political opponents.
I definitely think it's a witch hunt because, I mean, it's like crying wolf. How many times are they going to say he's indicted? And I just think, I do believe that it's also election interference. I believe that they really don't want him to run the establishment. I believe that they want to keep Biden in office.
A recent poll found that 12% of America says that the use of force is justified to keep Trump from winning the presidency, while 7% of Trump supporters say force is justified to restore Trump to the presidency.
I absolutely support it. And, I was just talking to my son yesterday when the fourth came through. And I'm like, you know, it's just hard for me to imagine that you could have someone, the leader of one of the world's best countries or used to be in the world, and he could try to overthrow a legitimate campaign vote. So, no, I'm all for the indictments.
The Georgia trial is the only of Trump's 4 indictments, which is likely to be televised. The indictments have often seemed timed to coincide to overshadow developments in the corruption allegations of Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden.
You know, we've been saying for a while that Trump is a criminal, and the issue is that we have a criminal system. So, Trump being indicted, we hope that he goes to jail. We hope that he goes to prison. I don't think that it's going to happen personally. But at the same time, you know, some of the people who are pushing these charges, you know, are also a part of this criminal system and also, you know, need to be held accountable for the things that they've done.
Trump's goal may be to delay the trials past the November 2024 vote, although he cannot pardon himself in the Georgia case, while Democrats are accused of slow-walking the investigations to tarnish Trump throughout the upcoming election campaign.
What the continued lawsuits make certain is that there will be no national reconciliation over the still disputed 2020 election, only further estrangement, and with no end in sight. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
On the 17th anniversary of the 2006 Israeli war against Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah underlined the prospects of the resistance front in the entire region.
I do not deny, as the Israeli war minister threatened, that they can take Lebanon back to the Stone Age. But I tell our enemy, based on evidence and facts, you also will be taken to the Stone Age. If you choose to go to war with Lebanon, you will be returned to the Stone Age. Our enemy can make a list of civilian and military obvious infrastructure in the area of occupied Palestine. They can calculate how many rockets the resistance needs to destroy all of these sites.
The Hezbollah leader stressed that the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the Resistance Alliance of the region have seized the initiative to a very high extent.
August 14, 2006, did not only signal the end of 33 days of Israeli hostilities, but it ushered in a new phase in the Israeli-Arab conflict. For the first time since its creation, Israel has been deterred from launching a new aggression for 17 years.
Western and Israeli reports published since the end of the 2006 war and until today mentioned that Hezbollah had a decisive victory over Israel with a lasting impact.
Any Western who has a freedom or was liberal to say the truth would do nothing but acknowledge the truth about the resistance and honor them, because in their books and their reports they acknowledge that those people performed very highly and they were not scared, and they were facing the tanks and the airplanes and all of this with their humble weapons. But as the other brother said, but they had a spirit that the Israeli will never have, because they're fighting for good cause.
Observers believe the war has set the cornerstone for a new age for the peoples of this region and the whole world.
What this victory has done to the mentalities is building a new way of thinking, way of victorizing against the enemies, especially the West and its culture. They cannot invade us again.
Israel's aggression killed around 1,300 Lebanese, mostly civilians. It destroyed thousands of residential buildings and houses and severely damaged Lebanese civil infrastructure and displaced approximately 1 million Lebanese. Maryam Saleh, Mlita, South Lebanon.
Groundwater pollution has reached an alarming level in the Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants, posing grave risks for Gazans. Israel has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewage systems and targeted them during wars. Water pollution poses serious health risks throughout the tiny coastal sliver.
The Israeli continuous blockade has severe implications on the situation of water in Gaza. 97% of the Gaza aquifer water is polluted due to the destruction happened on the last offensives that we witnessed in Gaza Strip.
More than 2 million Gazans are forced to buy filtered water in order to cook or drink. Tap water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. People only use it for house cleaning and doing the laundry.
Tap water is not suitable for drinking, and I think it's not even good for animals to drink. Tap water makes us sick, and we only use it to wash our clothes and to clean the house. My family spends a lot of money to buy filtered water. We only use filtered water to cook and drink.
Inhumane Israeli practices have taken their toll on the coastal sliver's drinking water. Water contamination levels are at least three times higher than the standards of the World Health Organization for safe drinking water.
More than 97% of Gaza's groundwater is polluted and does not meet the standards of the World Health Organization. The blockade and repeated Israeli military operations and the direct targeting of Gaza's vital infrastructure have also caused damage to water systems and affected water supply networks, further exacerbating the already existing water crisis.
The consumption of contaminated water at levels over international safety standards can cause potentially life-threatening diseases.
Years of Israeli siege and multiple wars since 2008 have devastated Gaza's water infrastructure and led to increasing levels of pollution in drinking water supplies. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Afghan women's restaurant is situated in the capital, Kabul, and serves traditional Afghan food. The restaurant is decorated with colorful fabrics, handicrafts, and flowers, and it is known for being run by and for women. The owners say it is a safe haven for women who want to enjoy a meal, socialize, and express themselves freely.
This restaurant is established to serve and help women. All of our employees and customers are women. We wanted to create a space where women can feel comfortable and hopeful and enjoy tasty Afghan traditional food. It's also aimed at offering jobs to women who are left without an income.
The women who work at the facility say they started working here after the Taliban banned them from other jobs and education. They call on the de facto government to reverse the restrictions on women's rights.
I was a student of law when the Taliban enforced the ban on universities. At the time, I felt so bad and depressed. In addition, our family was running out of money. Then I decided to join this restaurant. It is very beneficial and helpful for me. I call on the Taliban to restore our rights to work and education.
The restaurant is popular among women who come here to enjoy the food and the atmosphere. The customers say they appreciate the service and the solidarity that they find here.
I am a 12th grade student. I visit this restaurant because it is run by and for women. I come here to study, have Afghan hand-baked food, and socialize with my friends. I also want to meet new people and chat with them. I'm happy that at least we have this opportunity and service.
The restaurant is a rare example of women's empowerment and resistance in a country where the Taliban have imposed strict restrictions on women's rights. Despite the challenges and risks, Afghan women are not giving up on their dreams and aspirations. They're supportive of each other in the face of the imposed restrictions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The ratings agency Fitch has downgraded the credit ratings of the United States, saying the country's growing debt and repeated standoffs over the borrowing limit make it less trustworthy than before. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. A Fitch rating analyst warned that the U.S. banking industry has inched closer to another source of turbulence, the risk of sweeping rating downgrades on dozens of U.S. banks that could even include the likes of J.P. Morgan Chase. The ratings agency cut its assessment of the industry's health in June, a move that analyst Chris Wolf said went largely unnoticed because it didn't trigger downgrades on banks. But Chris Wolf told CNBC, another one-notch downgrade of the industry's score to A+ from AA- would force Fitch to reevaluate ratings on each of the more than 70 U.S. banks it covers. Chris Wolf added, if we were to move it to A+, then that would recalibrate all our financial measures and would probably translate into negative rating actions. The credit rating firms relied upon by bond investors have roiled markets lately with their actions. Recently, Moody's downgraded 10 small and mid-sized banks and warned that cuts could come from another 17 lenders, including larger institutions like Truist and U.S. Bank. Earlier this month, Fitch downgraded the U.S. long-term credit rating because of political dysfunction and growing debt load, a move that was derided by business leaders including J.P. Morgan Chase's Chief Executive Officer Jamie Dimon. Chris Wolf said, Fitch is intent on signalling to the market that bank downgrades, while not a foregone conclusion, are a real risk. The firm's June action took the industry's operating environment score to AA- from AA because of pressure on the country's credit rating, regulatory gaps exposed by the March regional bank failures, and uncertainty around interest rates. The problem created by another downgrade to A+ is that the industry's score would then be lower than some of its top-rated lenders. The country's two largest banks by assets, that is J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America, would likely be cut to A+ from AA- in this scenario, since banks can't be rated higher than the environment in which they operate. And if top institutions like JP Morgan Chase are cut, then Fitch will be forced to at least consider downgrades on all their peers' ratings, according to Chris Wolfe. That could potentially push some weaker lenders closer to non-investment grade status. Shares of lenders including JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America and Citigroup dipped in pre-market trading on Tuesday, 15th of August. For instance, Miami Lakes, Florida-based Bank United at BBB is already at the lower bounds of what investors consider investment grade. If the firm, which has a negative outlook, falls another notch, it would be perilously close to a non-investment grade rating. Chris Wolfe said he didn't want to speculate on the timing of this potential move or its impact on lower-rated firms. Chris Wolfe added, "We've had some decisions to make, both on an absolute and relative basis. On an absolute basis, there might be some BBB banks where we've already discounted a lot of things and maybe they could hold on to their rating." JP Morgan Chase declined to comment for this article, while Bank of America and Bank United didn't immediately respond to messages seeking comments. In terms of what could push Fitch to downgrade the industry, the biggest factor is the path of interest rates determined by the US Federal Reserve. Some market forecasters have said the Federal Reserve may already be done raising interest rates and could cut them next year, but that isn't a foregone conclusion. Higher interest rates for longer than expected would pressure the industry's profit margins. Analysts said that downgraded banks would have to pay investors more to buy their bonds, which further compresses profit margins. They even expressed concern that some banks could get locked out of debt markets entirely. Downgrades could also trigger unwelcome provisions in lending agreements or other complex contracts. Chris Wolfe said, "It's not inevitable that it goes down. We could be at AA- for the next 10 years. But if it goes down, there will be consequences." The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story and tells us more. Fitch Ratings Agency downgraded the credit ratings of the U.S. recently, saying the country's growing debt and repeated standoffs over borrowing limit make it less trustworthy than before. Fitch downgraded the United States from a rating of AAA to AA+, after several years of high-risk partisan battles over the debt limit. Those battles, Fitch said, had led to a spiraling national debt and a lack of faith in the U.S. government to handle it. Fitch wrote, "There has been a steady deterioration in standards of governance over the last 20 years, including on fiscal and debt matters, notwithstanding the June bipartisan agreement to suspend the debt limit until January of 2025. The statement added, "The repeated debt limit political standoffs and last-minute resolutions have eroded confidence in fiscal management." Fitch's downgrade comes roughly 3 months after President Joe Biden signed a deal to raise the debt limit just days before the U.S. was expected to default on its national debt. Fitch warned then that the growing debt, now well over $32 trillion, and Congress's inability to manage it in a productive and responsible way posed threats to the country's creditworthiness. Fitch said on Tuesday, 1st of August, "The government lacks a medium-term fiscal framework, unlike most peers, and has a complex budgeting process. These factors, along with several economic shocks as well as tax cuts and new spending initiatives, have contributed to successive debt increases over the last decade. Additionally, there has been only limited progress in tackling medium-term challenges related to rising Social Security and Medicare costs due to an aging population. Fitch also cited increased political polarization and partisanship as witnessed by the contested 2020 election in its June warning. The agency released its recent downgrade within moments of former President Donald Trump's indictment for his conduct and leading up to the 6th of January 2021 riots at the U.S. Capitol. The downgrade is an embarrassing blow for the U.S. government, which has long been considered one of the safest borrowers in global finance. Trillions of U.S. dollars and treasury bonds lay the foundation for the U.S. financial system. That has allowed the federal government to rack up limitless debt without economic blowback. While the ratings downgrade may have a largely symbolic impact, it comes as the United States and other major powers face rising interest rates. The U.S. Federal Reserve has boosted its baseline interest rate by 5.5 percentage points since March of 2022, as the central bank battles inflation. A lower credit rating may push U.S. interest rates even higher, though global market conditions could dampen the full impact. However, the timing of the downgrade did raise eyebrows among some economists.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip in this modern technological age, how can we focus on our ubudiyya? So, dear listeners, we are talking about how we can increase our focus in our ubudiyya, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. Of course, in this day and age where we are surrounded by technological advancements and scientific advancements, it seems like our life is just so incredibly busy. And to a certain extent, it is true. We are either busy with studies or we are busy with our jobs. We are busy with work. And then, of course, we are busy with the house as well. Each one of these different departments, if you want to call them, has its own problems, its own issues, and its own day-to-day struggles. Whether we are in school and trying to fight peer pressure, or trying to be good individuals despite the influence of certain bad individuals, or we're just trying to make good grades, or whether it is we are in the workplace and we are trying to get our job done, we are trying to get our work done on a daily basis. Or, for example, if we are running the household, which can be said to be one of the most complicated out of all three of these. For running the household truly is something that is very difficult, and it entails a lot of things that once again keep us busy. Now, in all this hustle and bustle and staying busy in the way that we do because of the different, you know, things that we are involved in our lives, we have a tendency to not be able to slow down. This not being able to slow down, or let's put it the other way around, being so entangled in these different aspects of life, it results in that we are going so fast. Our mind is moving so fast that when it comes to the time for our formal acts of worship, such as the five daily prayers, our mind is still racing. Now, when our mind is racing, we won't be able to truly focus on this formal ubudiyah, this service, this worship, and this obedience to the Almighty Allah. And of course, why are we focusing on the five daily prayers? Because, as you very well know, the five daily prayers are one of the strongest pillars of Islam, and it is known as the Mi'raj, the ascension of the mu'min, the ascension of the believer. Of course, as we have said in many of our programs, anything that we do which is good and righteous, and it is for the sake of gaining the nearness to the Almighty Allah, and if it is for the sake of gaining the satisfaction and the acceptance of the Almighty Allah, that is considered to be ubudiyah. But again, we're focusing on salah, on the namaz, on the five daily prayers, because it is such a pivotal and important aspect of the religion and of Islam. So like we were saying, we are moving so fast in this world that when it comes to the five daily prayers, our mind is still moving that fast and we're not able to focus. So what should we do? Because as we know, a salah, a prayer that is done without focus, without attention, without peace of mind, is not as valuable as one that is done with this focus and this presence of heart. So what should we do? We'll answer in the next segment.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we will listen to Sheikh Zayd As-Salami, who will talk about today's topic.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. As devout Muslims, we try to connect with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in any time we can. We try to seize the opportunity to build that relationship with the Almighty. And the best time for this is when we are exclusively on our own with Him. And that would be in the middle of the night, when everyone else is asleep. We have that quiet and calm and serene environment where I'm able to express my love and my building of relationship with the Almighty. And that's why it's so recommended to recite Salatul Layl, otherwise known as Tahajjud or Namaz-e-Shab. We have so many ahadith that speak about how good and beneficial this salah is, that it will give you knowledge, it will give you wisdom, it will illuminate your face, it will bring about rizq and sustenance. We even have a hadith that say that if you want to be a true Shi'i, then you need to be someone who prays Salatul Layl. It's not difficult to pray Salatul Layl, but the only thing you would need is good motivation. The closer you pray it to Salatul Fajr, the more recommended it is. All up, there are 11 rak'ahs that you are going to pray. 8 is called Nafilatul Layl, and they are 4 2 rak'ah prayers, so 2 2 2 2. And after that, you've got a 2 rak'ah prayer called Salatul Shafa', and at the end, you have a 1 rak'ah prayer called Salatul Witr. In Salatul Shafa', you pray the two rak'ah prayer with, in the first rak'ah, Surah Al-Hamd, then Surah Al-Tawheed, and then after that Surah Al-Nas, in the second rak'ah, you pray Surah Al-Hamd, Surah Al-Tawheed, and then Surah Al-Falaq. Then, when you finish that, you pray the one rak'ah prayer of Salatul Witr. In Salatul Witr, you do Suratul Fatiha, and then Suratul Tawheed, which you recite three times, and then Suratul Falaq, and then Suratul Nas. After that, with your misbaha, or if you want, you can use one of these tally counters. You say, Astaghfirullah Rabbi wa atubu ilayh 70 times. So you're in your qunut, and you have one hand down with your misbaha and the other hand up. You're looking at your palm and you are reciting the istighfar. After that, in your qunut, you do dua and you ask for forgiveness for 40 believers, be it your parents, your grandparents, your siblings, your spouse, your children, your teachers, your elders, your friends, 40 people you need to name. After that, it's recommended for you to say 300 times Al-Afu, Ilahi Al-Afu or Al-Afu. Then it is mustahab for you to say the other supplications that are recommended in the qunut of Salatul Witr. Like for example, Hada Maqamul A'idhi Bika Minan Nar, for you to say that 7 times, and many of the other du'as that are recommended in the Witr Salah in the qunut. And it's as simple as that. Let's say for example, you've had a hard day, it's difficult, you won't be able to do all of these, stick with Shafa' and Witr. Let's say you don't have time, just do the Witr. You want to do the 8 rak'ahs of Nafilatul Layl, don't do the second surah, just limit it to the Fatiha. You don't wake up and you only wake up for Salatul Fajr, which means you don't have any time. You can also do it as qadha during the day. But a guaranteed change will happen in your life should you carry on with such a wonderful habit to do. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin.
Welcome back to your listeners. So in continuation to what we were talking about, of course, which was this question where we left off the last segment, and that was, how do we focus and pay attention and really, I guess focus is the good word, have a presence of heart, you know, be in the moment when it comes to our 5 daily prayers, our salah and our namaz. Also, in the last segment, we had talked about how, you know, we are really living a life which is very fast-paced. And this fast-paced attribute of this world and of this modern age, what it does is that it does not allow you to be able to focus on certain realities and to focus, you know, on many things. Not only not focus on ourselves, but also not focus on our ubudiyah, our service, our worship, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. Now, in some of our programs, we had previously talked about formal ubudiyah and informal ubudiyah, so you should definitely check out those episodes to know what we are talking about. But of course, in our informal ubudiya, there is the necessity to have focus and attention and presence of heart. But in our formal ubudiya, such as the five daily prayers, the obligatory wajib prayers, it is an absolute must. So what should we do? Well, one of the things that is recommended in order to be able to focus in our daily prayers in this formal ubudiya that has been encouraged, emphasized, and therefore commanded by the Almighty Allah, is to really consider this prayer to be your last prayer. So before you start the prayer, or even while you're in the prayer, now don't actively think about it being your last prayer while you are praying. Meaning you don't want to distract yourself or, you know, lead your attention towards that fact where, you know, in fact, you should be paying attention to and focusing, you know, on the Almighty Allah or on what you are saying or, you know, in the state that you are in. But before you start the prayers, if you kind of think about it that this might be your last prayer, it will really do wonders when it comes to you being able to focus and really pay attention in this formal ubudiyah of the Almighty Allah. And of course, in next sessions, we'll talk a little bit more about this because it is really a vast topic and it is a vast subject that can really be discussed very beautifully. Now, unfortunately, there's not enough time on the program to be able to do that. But, you know, again, just as a very general piece of advice, and of course, this piece of advice does not come from myself. It comes from the Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. And His Eminence says that you should pray your prayers, you should do your salah as if it is your last salah. And inshallah, this should be able to help us to focus more on our ubudiyah, our service, our worship, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.